time to take a listen to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Oniroa. Last Saturday, Sharon talked to Merrill contender Len Brown, Luke Andrews from the Kenner Backpackers, Rosalie Hennigan from Waiheke Library, and Jay Clark from the Gulf District Plan Association.
Len, you've come over to Waiheke for the day?
Yeah, oh. Great to be over in Waiheke.
Great.
Yeah, fabulous to be here. Beautiful island. Quite a nice trip over too. Cameron's
got risky shipping. Not too much of a chop out there, and it was just really, it's always brilliant to just climb off the old ferry at Kennedy Point and away we go.
Lovely. Do you come over often?
Yep, quite a history with Waiheke. Tell you the truth, it was the first time my wife and I went away on a lovely long holiday was in Waiheke, and we were up on Hauraki Road, and we had lots and lots of holidays here since.
Lovely. Okay, so what brings you over today? What are you doing?
Just coming over. Obviously, I've announced that I'd like to be the mayor of all of Auckland. And this is an opportunity to come and see you. Say good day to everybody out there as your listeners. And to just meet other media. And going to be going around the market, taking a few of the sights and sounds of the place, and just enjoy ourselves 3 or 4 hours.
Mm. So do we know when the elections are?
Yep, elections next year. You will have your new mayor, your new council and your new local boards on the 1st of November next year. And the voting papers, it'll be a voting by post, mail post, and so they will be out 3 weeks before that date.
Right. Okay. And do we know who's standing so far?
Well, the only ones who have declared are myself and the Mayor of Auckland, John Banks, your great mayor.
Right. Okay. So you've got a good track record at Manukau. You seem quite popular there. What do you think?
I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
What are some of the challenges you see as the super city mayor?
Oh, big challenges. There's two real challenges. One, to really get the city into an appropriate shape where we can really move forward. First one is really to bring the communities together. I think that this is, for many people in the Auckland region, not a marriage that they are willing participants in. The first thing, and that's why my byline is the Mayor for All of Auckland, is a real process of reaching out to all of the communities and bring people into the idea of the Auckland Council. And secondly, through this process, to really advocate a vision for Auckland and how we go forward, and through that 12-month period, for the community to accept and support one of the visions from one of the candidates and buy that, agree that, and then really lift off from that point.
Right. Okay, well, that's an interesting point, because this idea of bringing communities together, I mean, that sounds quite positive, except for the fact that Auckland communities are extremely diverse. I mean, if you look at the challenges and also the culture that you've got in South Auckland, that's very different from what there is in West Auckland, and very, very different from the problems and also the culture of Waiheke. Mm. So how will bringing things together match retaining diversity and dealing with the challenges that each place has?
Okay, so we've got a two-tier system that we're developing, and we're getting there?
Yeah, you need to face straight on.
Facing straight on. So I'm going to face straight on now. We've presently got a three-tier system where we've got the Auckland Regional Council and the Territorial Local Authority, 7 of them, and then community boards. In Manukau, we've got 8 community boards. And so under the two-tier system, we'll have the Auckland Council led by the Mayor, and then we'll have local councils and potentially anything up to 30 of those. And, of course, Waiheke's going to have their own local council. And a lot of how well we continue to deliver in terms of local community interests, local traditions, sort of support for a local identity, will come through at that at local board level. And so I guess we're really waiting. We're going to hear, I think, next Friday, the proposals for the local board structure and what sort of delegations that will be given to the local boards. Now, our council and all of the councils around the region, to be honest, we're in agreement that we really need to delegate strong responsibilities in economic, social and environmental issues, service delivery to the local boards. So if the government follow through, and certainly the principles in the second bill look like they will, then the local boards will seriously be able to, you know, sort of really look after most of the local issues and deliver to the Auckland Council the local issues viewed through a community board council plan, going in and to be plugged into the council's wider plan every year. So I think there will be there should be the structure in place to be able to deliver a continuing, one, a seamless transition, and two, continuing strong support and identity for the local communities. The key, the kicker will be who the leader is, what sort of philosophy and vision that leader is espousing, and secondly, who your local councillor is going to be and how well that council will work together in delivering out that vision.
At the same time, there seem to be quite severe structural issues, so that in a way, yes, the human thing is important, but we're running the risk of not having the structures in place so that those things can then be manipulated by people.
Yeah, look.
I wanted to talk to you about... Oh, sorry. Did you?
Well, I guess one of the things that we get, that I certainly get fed back to me, and which we're particularly sensitive about, is the structure and the fact that we're in a pretty brief time frame. So everyone in local government, certainly the councils, and I know the Auckland Transition Authority, are really focused on ensuring that the bare bones of the structure is in place so that on the 2nd of November, everything continues apace, that there's no graunching to a dead halt because computers don't work or, you know, the phones have gone down, you know, the first, second, third, fourth tier of management and administration is not in place. All of that stuff will be in place. I'm certainly firmly focused on ensuring that we're in a space where on the 2nd of November we are go.
Okay, that sounds good. So that's lucky. why was the super city, the idea of the super city brought in? What problems was it specifically brought in to address?
I think the lack of cohesion on infrastructure development in particular. I don't think there was an issue around, hey, look, the local council didn't represent its community and wasn't promoting its community strength well enough. It was, as a region, a sense that we weren't gelling and being unified enough around infrastructure, particularly public transport delivery, roading transport delivery, communications in and around broadband, power delivery. So key infrastructure delivery, there was a concern that we were not united enough on that. And that secondly, all of our district schemes and plans, for those involved in developing or building anything, they're dealing with seven different plans across the region, plus the ARC overarching the lot. And it just is, the view was that it was just way too complicated and lacking in a unifying sense.
Okay,
and I guess maybe the thing that was the one that really kicked it off for Parliament was what happened when we got involved in the debate about the stadium 4 years ago on the waterfront, and there was just massive lack of seeming leadership and agreement around that.
Mm.
And I think for Parliament, for both Labor and National, the two key parties there, that was it.
Right. Okay. That's interesting, because in some ways I feel that we're kind of losing sight of the ball, which is the fact that for Aucklanders, transport is an absolute nightmare, and it's a nightmare for people coming in from South Auckland who spend forever trying to get to work in their cars because maybe they feel public transport isn't that great. And of course, you know, advances are being made in that area. But basically, essentially, it's issues around integrated ticketing, affordability of transport.
Yeah.
And yet, I think a lot of time is being taken up with, you know, standardising things which maybe don't need to be standardised. I don't know. So where are we moving with the integrated ticketing, and where
is the position on that? Yeah, of course, the news on that is it's just been approved. It's been a very long process, probably 10 years in the bringing together. And so ARTA have just formalised a contractual arrangement to bring in and integrated ticketing. There's a lead time into it, but still the contractual arrangement has finally been done, and that's fabulous. It's a key part to it. I know how important this is for the island. I mean, you're completely dependent on ferry transport, really. Very strong advocate for ferry transport. I think that we don't put as strong an emphasis on the building of our ferry networks as we do on bus and rail. Over the last 5-10 years in particular, there have been some really good movements in our area, and you refer to that. We've had 300% increases every year for the last 5 years on our southern rail network, to a point where we're now at critical mass. So we desperately need to enable us to step up to the next level of public transport usage, the electrification of the suburban line, as well as the new rolling stock. And so that that change has seen, you know, it's the old story, you build it and they'll use it. So there are, through this next 12 months, will be a major opportunity for the community to really know and understand what is possible in terms of the retrofitting of our transport system, and particularly public transport. So major lifting of rapid transit links, in particular rail connection and investment in rail. We need to double the bus patronage and bus route options for us right around the region, including here. I know how well you use bus on the island. And lastly, ferry. We're beginners. We've completely lost our ferry system, and so we are really back to trying to retrofit. For example, in Manukau, we've got the Half Moon Bay ferry terminal that needs a major upgrade. It's going to cost $80 million, but we're at critical mass. And a point of no further growth possible until such time as we do that in Half Moon Bay. So on all fronts of public transport, we need to step from our present 6 to 7% usage of public transport to 15% for us to really be confident that we have future-proofed our transportation needs going into our mutual futures. So that's probably going to be the main debate right through this campaign, because it's got the biggest dollar signs to it, billions and billions, probably $20 billion worth of public transport upgrades over the next 20 years. You know, the rail link between the airport, seaport, rail cross the harbour. You know, do we replace the bridge? Do we need a tunnel? What's the appropriate link through there?
What's your feeling around that?
I'm probably more a bridge person than tunnel, tell you the truth. Right into it, speaking in. I can understand the simplicity of the tunnel, but I actually think in terms of cost-benefit ratios and in terms of what we can deliver as an iconic structure and as a structure that would be multi-transportational, so you could do walking, cycling, bus, rail and car on an appropriate... See, Bill, on an appropriate Auckland Bridge, then I really like that. And some of the work being done around costings now is really showing it to be maybe a preferable option. Richard Simpson is a promoter of an iconic bridge design that has been doing the rounds in Auckland over recent months. Great thinking. And for me, there are both in New Zealand and outside of New Zealand people of eminence who can deliver us designs that I think could be something very, very special. We're going to have a discussion and debate if we go for a bridge, a multi-crossing like that, as to what we do with the existing bridge. That would be interesting. Mm. That would be emotional. But I don't think that it should compromise the fact that we have got some challenges in terms of its present structure and its capacity.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Yeah. No, another thing around the ferry specifically.
Yes.
Obviously, oil prices are going up, and so, you know, potentially ferries can become more and more expensive over the long term. Mm. So,
subsidies.
What do you suggest? Subsidies? Is that the way forward?
Yeah.
I mean, the problem that we currently have with the ferry operators that work in the hierarchy Gulf, are that they are run by shareholders. So there is a certain profit that needs to be returned to shareholders. And if you talk to Mike Lee of the ARC, he strongly feels that we shouldn't be subsidising ferries, but that there should be more competition on the route.
Well, look, we've desperately tried to get competition on the route, as he knows. It's there have been the scraps with the ferry operators have been legend, and we've all been a part of those.
That's
so,
right. There was a whole thing on the Half Moon Bay Ferries.
Oh, well, we were right in the middle of it. And that basically was one of the primary problems about our upgraded Half Moon Bay, was the constant litigation between the parties who really wanted to provide competition there. It's still quite a small sort of service. And so in that sense, it's been hard to really get good competition in there. And variously over the years, there's been some consideration given to, you know, sort of public ownership as a way of ensuring and guaranteeing a strong, vibrant service. But it's problematic to get competition in a service that, to this point in time, is nowhere near its capacity. At one point, as you know, it was the primary mode of connection between the North Shore of the islands and the South. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, with the Harbour Bridge and all the other motorway options, it's not that there. So it's been very much the poor cousin as an option. But I just want the listeners to be aware of this. I mean, over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to see a doubling of the number of cruise ships coming into the Auckland Harbour. And I suspect that's light. We're going to do something really spectacular on Queen's Wharf as a cruise ship terminal. And so we're getting increasing numbers of tourists. That's going to double or triple. We are getting around the harbour at this point in time because of the gold card, major increases with the elderly. And so visits in and around the harbour to the islands and between the two shores are going to increase rapidly. So that may open up the opportunities for more competition, but you can't force it. What we've got to do is set the groundwork and the platform for it. And so we need to really work on our wharves and our terminal upgrades to enable that competition to grow and usage to grow.
And also keep it affordable.
Doing everything we can. So, of course, the issue of subsidies is always the one that raises its head. You know, you seriously subsidise buses and seriously subsidise rail. And so if we are to say that ferry, bus and rail are equally important in terms of public transport and the delivery of vision for people moving in our city, then we should be looking at that at the same time.
Sounds fab.
Do you like that?
I do.
Nice.
Now, listen, I just want to ask you one other thing, which is on public ownership, because you touched on that.
Yep.
So where are we with the public ownership? Because there's, again, a sort of a conflict between Rodney Hyde and the government, whose basic aim seems to be to privatise all the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And
no.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
Right.
People like myself and Mike Lee, Bob Harvey, have very, very strong commitment to the retention of assets. That comes off a philosophical base, but also comes off a commercial base. In Monaco, we've held our airport shares, 10.06%, in fact, increased it a little bit in the last 3 years, over 20 years, never sold it. And our community, and I know the communities across the region, I bet Waiheke in particular, has a very strong commitment to the philosophy of the owning and retending and retention of key public utilities and assets like airports, seaports, public transport when we own it, parks assets, land assets,
libraries.
And libraries, pools and recreation centres. We love our libraries. Water, of course, wastewater. So those assets are monopolies. They're absolute monopolies, and you build great cities off them. And if you manage them well, they can be cost neutral and even earn income for you. Our airport shares bring in about $10 million per annum for the Manukau community, means it's a $10 million less rates that we have to ask for. And so, you know, these assets are the lifeblood, they're the lifeline of our city's development.
So how can that be enshrined in law?
It is enshrined in law. And the only way it's not enshrined as law is if Rodney has his way and persuades John Key and his cabinet to change. And I think they want that one like a hole in the head. I don't think there's any sentiment for that type of change around the cabinet table, as much as there's none for Rodney's proposal that we need to, you know, curb local government to core services only. You know, they just found that too hard, and we're getting one hell of a message from New Zealand. Local government and its community have worked out what core services are over 160 years and don't tell us any different.
Yeah. Well, it was great if we can protect them, but there seems to be a huge threat, obviously, with the way the government is structured at the moment, and the fact that it often seems unclear whether they're actually doing things for the New Zealand public or whether they're doing...
Okay, so just go back to the water, because I guess people have sort of seen recent change that is proposed, which has to do with opening up management options for water asset. I'm looking long and hard at that legislation. Am I on here? Doing okay?
Yeah,
looking long hard at that legislation, and there's a bit of concern. Hey, look, is this sort of the first step in offloading the water so we, you know, sort of put it in long-term management to overseas international companies and then maybe sort of quietly just switch it over to ownership? I don't see anything along those lines in the legislation. You know, so ownership will stay in the hands of the public of this region unless Parliament changes the law as it stands, and I do not see that.
Lovely. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me. And what are you up to today then? Who are you talking to?
Well, we're just going to generally chill out around the island. As I say, we're going to talk to your Golf New guys and your Marketplace guys, and we're going to meet up with your local councillor, Councillor Denise, and probably some of the local leaders, and I'll get my ears ringing and get a box around the ears and just knock me into shape so that if I become the mayor, I'm fully aware of the needs and aspirations of Waiheke, but I don't need that because this is a special place. And my family has a strong attachment to it, as do we Aucklanders, and so we just want to make sure the place is well managed and cared for in the years ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and... good luck with your campaign.
Yeah, and look, for listeners, you don't know, but this our lovely news presenter here this morning is sitting with Shake of Ara on a T-shirt. Hey, boy, heck, he's a state of revolution.
Absolutely.
Lovely to talk to you all.
Constant revolution. Keep them on their toes.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
Okay, well, I'm here with Luke from the newly branded Kinner Backpackers in Onitangi. It's that beautiful location up on the hill at Onitangi. So, so tell us, Luke, what's the change?
Well, we've taken over the lease from the Auckland City Council. They were running it for the last 4 years or so, and they had employed some managers, Dwayne and Vanessa Marshall, and they'd been managing the place for about 4 years. Yeah, so we took over the lease, and we're hopefully going to be there for the next decade.
All right, okay, great. Have you got children?
Yeah, we've got two boys, Adam, who's 4, and Hunter, who's just turned 1.
Lovely. So it's part of that whole thing of also.
Yeah.
Kids grow up on Waiheke.
Yeah, having the kids grow up on Waiheke and having one of us at home looking after the kids all the time. So they still go to daycare and kindergarten and stuff, but not for sort of any great length of time.
Terrific. And so can I just ask you, why has it been rebranded Kinner Backpackers?
It's been rebranded Kinner Backpackers because we just felt that it needed a fresh look for the marketplace. The old brand name had been around for a while, and it just felt to us to be a bit tired. And it also, there was a bit of sort of serendipity about it. We'd handed in the business plan to the council, and we were walking as a family along Ofanaki Beach, and Aaron found a perfectly intact kinner shell.
Wow.
Which is very rare to find one of those. And then a good friend of ours, Lyndall Jeffries, artist on the island, she said, oh, that it'd be really cool to paint a mural on the side of the backpackers, and she sent through a piece of artwork she thought would look good, and it happened to be a kinner. And Aaron said, well, that means it has to be called Kinner. It just has to be one of those things.
Yeah.
So then we got Dominic, who did the logo for the Waiheke Radio. We approached him and said to him that we wanted a logo that had something to do with Kinner, and that was it. And he went off. 2 weeks later, he came back with that design, and it was... you know, it just blew us away, actually. It was really, really cool.
Mm. Oh, no, lovely. So how many people do you get through every year?
Well, at this stage, we've been there 4 weeks. We're hoping to be running at an average of 40% occupancy for the whole year, which is our sort of, that's our target. Tonight, for example, I'm full. For the first time that I've been working there in the 4 weeks, I'm 100% full tonight. No spare beds at all, so which is good. Enjoying that. Busy, though. Very busy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how many beds are there?
There's 40 beds.
Wow, I didn't realise it was so big.
Yeah, a lot of people get fooled by it from the frontage, but it's actually quite a long building. It goes quite a way back. It's there's a 7-bed dorm room, 5 rooms with double beds, and then everything else is just twin bunk rooms.
So what does it cost to stay?
The dorm room's $24 a night, and then the twin bunk rooms are $28, and the double rooms are $65.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what do you... is it mostly people who have no connection with Waiheke coming over, or is it tourists? Is it
it's mostly tourists.
Vineyards?
At the moment, I've got 3 Irishmen, a Frenchman, 2 Germans.
Sounds like a joke.
A Norwegian... Does a Norwegian, 3 Kiwis. The 3 Kiwis are girls, actually, and they're all working for the vineyard contractors on the island.
Right.
Yeah, so they get weekly rates. And then there's a few other people that are working in hospitality around the island, and they're paying weekly rates at the moment too. But no, it's good, actually. It's really good. We've put a couple of improvements in. We've stuck in a wireless internet system, so that people, if they want to, can bring along their any wireless device they have, and they can surf the internet or do whatever they want for $2 an hour. I bake 2 loaves of fresh bread every morning and leave them out in the kitchen, and that's free for the backpackers to use.
That's incentive to get up early.
Oh, it's really great, eh? They get up and they just smell that fresh bread smell going wafting through the backpackers, and they love it. It's good.
Oh, it's magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gives it that little extra touch, I think. And we're doing other things too, like we're starting to dig over and prepare a vegetable patch for the backpackers to use. And we're also going to be also sticking up a chicken coop and get fresh eggs. So that'll be for the backpackers as well.
That sounds like magic, and also a nice thing for the family and
get involved
with that.
We'd love to, get more families overstaying with us, actually. So it'll be good.
Great. So tell us about tonight.
Tonight we're having our opening, our opening bash, our opening party. We've invited everybody that we can think of that's associated with tourism on the island, and getting them around to Kinder Backpackers to say who we are and what we're about, and just to come and have a few drinks and enjoy our company for a couple of hours. And hopefully the weather stays, hopefully the weather doesn't turn. It stays nice for the rest of the day, but
yeah, well,
we're looking forward to it.
Sounds promising. Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Great. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Sharon. It's really nice.
Great. So I've been talking to Luke, who's proudly sporting a Waiheke Radio T-shirt, which looks so great on him. And he's from Kinner Backpackers, which has just recently been rebranded. It's the backpackers up on the Onitangi Strait, and presumably on up near Onitangi Beach.
Yep.
And so can you organise parties there, like if there were local people who had some people coming over?
Oh, yeah. No, I've already had 2 approaches. Labour Weekend next year, we're actually looking at having the National Earth Building Conference there. So that's people that build houses and dwellings essentially out of earth and earth sod,
right,
and look at building more sustainably that way.
Sounds great. I just had this vision of it being people who are fed up with the way the earth is now, like making another one next door.
Yeah, no. They're just people who want to try and find natural ways of building, I guess, and that's what the way they look at it. Different things, and then somebody's organising a 40th birthday there at Easter this year. So they're basically booking the whole place out. So, and I've had a few other inquiries from groups over in Auckland. So it's looking good.
Sounds fab.
Mm.
Okay, well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Happy birthday to us! Yes, Waiheke Radio is turning 1. And to celebrate, we're throwing a party. The Waiheke Radio First Birthday Bash, Saturday, November the 28th at Mora Hall in Oniroa. And we've got Don McGlashan and the Seven Sisters to help with the festivities. Dominion Road is banded. with support from the Nicky Natai Band and Waiheke Radio's very own B Squared Blues Band, plus the Blackpool Boys and the mighty Jibsco Sound System, we're going to blow out the candle in style. Tickets are $28, available from Island and Oniroa, or $30 on the night. There is no depression in New Zealand. So help us celebrate our birthday, Saturday 28th of November from 7 o'clock. Tickets $28 from Island and Oniroa.
Hi Rosalie, how's it going?
Hi Sharan, and a big wonderful hello to everyone on wonderful Waiheke. We haven't got such a great day today, but hey, it's mild. And oh, I must say a big thank you to all the people for the garden display last weekend. I was working on Saturday, but Sunday my niece and I went over and we just went round some of the most beautiful gardens in the world. Just tremendous. Such work people have put into them. You're wonderful, Waiheke.
Incredible. Yeah. Yes. Did you buy anything? I met someone who bought some orchids, got some lovely orchids really cheap, so she was really, really happy.
No. Well, actually, I did. A peaches and cream magnolia from Wells Bay.
Oh.
And a big thank you to the people down there because it was only $3 for a little wee magnolia. Ah!
Great. Do you know how much money was raised?
I don't yet. I'm sorry. I haven't seen the figures, so...
Mm. Heaps, so, of course, we're talking about the Jesse Dean Garden Safari that was last weekend.
Yes.
But hopefully they raised as much money as they raised last year. They always seem to do very well, so that's
great.
Yes,
well, they deserve to, but the people who do the gardens are absolutely wonderful. Now, I'm not here to talk gardens. I'm here to talk books. And last week, Sharon, I talked about the Adults Man Booker Prizes. So this time I thought, you know, some of those Booker Prizes, some of the long lists and short lists that I've been reading, some of them are great books and others are. Well, I've got one at the moment and it's a bit of a struggle. 2 weeks to read a book, isn't that terrible? So I haven't given up on it. I'm reading it in my lunch hours and my afternoon tea breaks for 5 minutes at a time. And it started off so well.
What is it? What can you say or you're not allowed to say?
Well, yes, I can say. It was The Glass Room by Simon Morber, and it was in the shortlist. So usually the shortlist of the Man Booker are very, very good. But however, this time I'm going to talk about children's books because I needed a break and I needed some good storytelling. And I went to the Carnegie Medal winner and I picked out one, Frank Cottrell Boyce. It's not rocket science. Cosmic. And cosmic is something that you hear the teens and the kids saying, oh, something is cosmic, like the garden tour, they would say, oh, that was really cosmic. And this guy really tells a wonderful story. And he tells it about a boy who's very tall for his age and is always getting mistaken for much older. And, you know, people think he's an adult and he's just a school kid. But he's in the gifted and talented class, in inverted commas. So, of course, he knows a heap of stuff. And he's got a huge interest in rocket science. And when he sees this website about rocket science, he goes into it and basically he becomes one of the people. He nominates himself, of course, and signs his father's name, which, of course, we can't recommend. But he gets to China where this person has developed a rocket and is secretly going to send these children up into space because she wants to them to do it as guinea pigs for when she does the real official one with her daughter.
All right.
So it's a quite involved story of what happens to these kids. And you think they're going to all die at one stage and it's quite horrifying. And I was thinking, this is a kid's book. They can't do that. And
all
of course,
right.
They
so
have a triumphant return. Yes.
Famous Five, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it certainly is. It's out of this world. It's Cosmic by Frank Cottrell Boyce, and I really enjoyed it.
And so what age group is that for?
Well, I would say from 10 to 15, because that's a hugely longer spence. But I'm considerably older than 15, and I really enjoyed it. So if you have interest in rocket science or in space or in astronomy, then I think it will appeal to a slightly older age group than what it was originally intended for. The same can be said for Ian Colfer, and he's the mega-selling author of the Artemis Fowl books, which I absolutely love. There's so much humour and so much adventure, and they're great books. Now, this one came out last year and, of course, created immediate sensation, so I waited, and so the holds have come off it now, so I can speak about it. And again, it's to do with space. This goes back to 1878, an imaginary island just off the coast of Ireland and England. An Airman is the title. Now, the other thing, they say you learn something every day. Now, I've been calling him Ian Colfer for, I hate to say, how many years.
The name's spelled E-O-I-N, by the way.
Yes. And, of course, it's, according to the blurb on the black, Ian, pronounced Owen, by the way, Colfer was born and raised in Wexford, Ireland. He began writing plays at an early age, forcing his unfortunate classmates to dress up as marauding Vikings when they would have preferred to be outdoors doing some marauding of their own. There's so much humour even in the blurb. And also, for people who have read Artemis Fowl, you'll know that fairies and elves and goblins come into it quite a lot. It says here in the blurb, no fairies were required in the making of this book, which I think is quite delightful. Now, if I start talking Afghans, lamingtons, sponge drops, Highland biscuits, butterfly cakes, apricot shortcake, birthday sponge cake, marble cake, cinnamon tea cake, what does that bring to mind?
Yum.
It does indeed. And I do enjoy baking, and I have some old recipes myself, which are very tattered and torn. And this is a book, Ladies a Plate, by Alexa Johnston. Now, I would have thought that the last thing I needed was another recipe book, because I've got a big shelf full and then I've got them spilling over into the drawer. But this has got all the Kiwi favourites. It's in baking. It's just superb. And I took them home and I compared some of my best recipes, which have been altered by my aunts and my mothers. And they were so like them in a couple of cases, which I think is the greatest recommendation I can give it. Alexa Johnston, I was here for the Waiheke Literary Festival, which was a wonderful success. And I attended her session and I came away full of respect for her, because she's more of a scientist, really, in the way she's put all these old recipes going back and beyond Aunt Daisy and the Women's Institute books. And she's worked out what should be the best recipes. And she's tried and tested them. And she's photographed them herself, because she said she produced the book on a shoestring. So if you're wanting a good cookbook for Christmas, be assured this is going on my list. My sisters will be getting it, I think. And possibly there'll be one in my own bag for me. Ladies a Plate, a traditional home baking Kiwi style by Alexa Johnston.
Oh, well, it looks delectable. It's got some amazing things in here. It's got apricot shortcake. That sounds like fun.
It's just
it's
about
got
lunchtime,
about five different
isn't
kinds
it?
Of ginger biscuit, ginger cake. And there was something
I love
else
ginger.
Here that I thought was quite good. It had, I think, banana cake, and then in bracket, keeps well.
And I thought, fat chance in my household.
Well, anyway, it just looks really delicious. So I think I'm going to be borrowing that one.
Yes. Well, I thought I would borrow it, but now I can recommend to people borrow it from the library, and then you might want to buy it.
Great. Well, thank you very much. So that was Rosalie from the library with two children's books and a baking book for you. Great.
A pleasure, and I'll be back in a fortnight.
Lovely. Thanks, Rosalie. Right. Well, lovely. Well, I've got Jay Clark here from the District Plan Association with me. So, Jay, can you tell us what the District Plan Association is? Because it sounds incredibly boring.
Ah, well, it is probably boring for most of us. We're a neighbourhood law support group, really. That's really what we've been doing. We set up the Citizens Advice Bureau way back in 1986. And from that, we realised there was still a gap in assisting the community in achieving the goals that we all want, which is a pleasant, beautiful place to live and continue to. So attend to those people who see something happening near them and they say, help, what can I do? And so those of us that have been around for a while and those of us that have some knowledge of the law, whether it's environmental planning or natural justice, will give advice. And not only do we do that, but we also have this incorporated society, so that so often we saw people would try and stand up to a development nearby and then hear the heavy footsteps of someone serving them a warrant on their doorstep, and they immediately take fright and say, God, I don't want to be left holding the baby for this development that's happening here, so what do I do? So the Incorporated Society of GDP, Gulf District Plan, it was really short for the Hauraki Gulf District Plan. That was set up in 96 when our current district plan, which is under review at the moment, became operative, which means it became the document by which everything would happen on the island and in the Hauraki Gulf. So we not only are a neighborhood law support group, but we also say, here's a vehicle in which you can drive your concerns through to the various forum, whether it's a council hearing or a environment court or even the High Court. We've been in the High Court before now. And so we just assist people and we give them some support in which to do that. So we're not a watchdog group. We are a support group that helps people who've got a concern. So when we had the Matiatia development going on, when John Banks was pushing that, GDP was trying to stop that, but we realized that it was necessary for the whole island to be involved in that. And as you can imagine, GDP isn't always everybody's best friend, because sometimes we upset some people by saying, we don't think your development or your subdivision or whatever is in the best interest of the community. So that's where Kapau was born. And Kapau was essentially GDP membership setting up to organize the defense of Matiatia. So those are the sorts of things we've done since 1981.
So what kinds of things are you involved with at the moment?
Well, we've got about a dozen campaigns running at the moment. The district plan is the main one. As you may have heard, the district plan was formally notified by the council after they heard all our submissions. And we have some 200 or 300 submissions there. And so the district plan is one of them. We've got many submissions in there. We've paid the $500 that you have to pay to the Environment Court to go there. We've got two appeals running against Mr. Spencer. We spent 3 days at hearings for Ofiti Bay a couple of months ago, people might remember. And the ARC is taking that to the Environment Court. We're with that one.
So what's happening? Perhaps you can give us some details on some of these things. So Ofiti Bay, where are we at with that?
Well, it's had its hearing stage. We attended 3 days of hearings and supported City Council and the ARC and originally Ngāti Poa against the proposal of putting that large house on Ofiti Bay.
So essentially Ofiti Bay is a bit of pristine coastline that doesn't have any buildings on it.
Exactly.
And the Spencer family or trust are proposing to build quite an extensive building right on the foreshore.
Exactly.
So
that's still heading for the Environment Court, and GDP is a partner with ARC in that one. So if GDP folds next month, as is intended in the High Court, then we are no longer able to attend to that appeal. We have other matters we've got interest in. The marina is one.
Can you tell us about the marina? Because that seems like a very strange proposal to put a marina. I mean, in Matiatia.
Yeah, it does seem to conflict with everything else that's going on in Matiatia. Matiatia is the busiest bay on the island, and somehow it's going to be, if some people have their way, divided further and incorporate more traffic and more activity there, whereas there must be other bays. And I read a letter somewhere saying Patiki Bay would be better for a marina. If we have to have a marina, then maybe it shouldn't be in the busiest part of Waiheke, which is Matiatia.
Yeah, I feel quite strongly about that as well, especially as it is that gateway transport hub. And I can just imagine all these boats going in and out, plus taking up space, plus the ferries trying to get in and out. It just sounds like a nightmare.
Well, this is the third attempt to have a marina there. Those of us that have lived around the island since Bill Starkey's days, I think some people will sit up and say, oh, Bill Starkey, remember the bulletin? That's back in 1981-82. Bill, wanted to have a marina there, and then there was another attempt to have a marina, floating the marina idea in the 90s as well. So this is number three attempt at Matiatia marinas, and I think this is doomed to fail like the other two, where it's really not the appropriate place. But this is where GDP is constantly involved with other appeals. I was thinking of one. You'd be amazed that there's a three-story house built on Onotangi Beach at the western end, and City Council notified that some 5 years after it being built for submission, so GDP put in a submission. And since then, this is 1999, that's 10 years ago, Auckland City Council has failed to bring that to a hearing because they're so embarrassed by it, I think. And so City Council has got good reasons to want GDP to disappear as well. So there's a lot of people, and the council, would really like to get rid of the thorn in their sides, because that thorn is saying, excuse me, we haven't finished with this yet, or excuse me, the community wants a say, like the marina. We haven't had a say in that yet. Our community board somehow has the wisdom to decide that it wishes to proceed on a 3-2 vote, I believe that was. So there's a need for the community group, and we have at least a dozen matters before the courts or before the council that need to be finished with. So that's why we need the support of the community to keep it going, keep it alive, and pay off this this fine that the Environment Court handed down against us, we believe unjustly, but we didn't have the money to defend ourselves on
so
that.
So can you explain what that's all about? We've seen it in the Gulf News or in the marketplace. Yes. Mm. So can you just explain the whole history of that? So the Gulf District Plan Association was defending...
Yeah, the headland at Quarry Road, where it overlooks Palm Beach, the owner there wanted to build a second large house right on the edge of the coast there, which was, in landscape terms, quite unacceptable. It went to a independent commissioner hearing because the council felt they couldn't get involved. So independent commissioner said, no, that house shouldn't go there. And GDP was there representing about 30 or 40 local residents, one or two of them from overseas who only come back to Waiheke every Christmas, let's say. So we represented those people, and we employed and paid for our expert evidence and our people at court to defend that when it finally went from the commissioners to the Environment Court. In between time, Auckland City Council was negotiating with the developer to modify their plans. We weren't involved in many of those discussions, although we would have loved to have been. And then when we got to the Environment Court, a new set of plans was proposed. We still said these were not good enough. And the Environment Court judge modified those plans even further, but then accused GDP of not participating in every meeting. We were there for the Environment Court and the commissioner hearings, but we weren't privy to the private meetings going on between City Council and the developers. So we got wrapped over the knuckles, and we couldn't afford to challenge that. That would have been another High Court action if we were to take it to challenge the judge on his fining not of 10% of the cost of the developer's fee, which would have been $4,000, which we could have accepted, but 50% of the developer's fees of his attending the Environment Court. So we've ended up with a $20,000 bill. So we've offered to pay off that. We've accepted that the court has said we owe $20,000, and we're prepared to put ourselves in front of the district court and show what we have in terms of assets and what our intentions are. Intentions are to honour the debt, but we can't do it today, we can't do it tomorrow. And like everybody else, we're cash-strapped, there is a recession on. People in the past would have been able to say, here you are, GDP, here's $10,000, here's $5,000, pay whatever it costs to keep going, because we need that independent voice that's prepared to scrutinise and prepared to stand up to any proposal that comes on in the Hauraki Gulf. This is Great Barrier as well as the islands and the waters of the Gulf. Mm-hmm. So we've at the moment run out of the enough money to pay that immediately. We can pay $20,000. We've already put up two plans to refund that, but the developer seems to want his pound of flesh rather than the money. I think the intention is to get rid of GDP and all the campaigns we've got going at the moment, because they, the campaigns, go down with GDP. So that's why we need people who particularly have an interest in some of the things we're working on, like the district plan, and whether there's a development going on next door to you or could be fast-tracked under the new district plan. You need to support GDP so that we can continue our work in the Environment Court.
Have you got any ideas for fundraising? Are you trying to do some fundraising?
Yes, there are people who have offered to put up a stall down at the market every Saturday morning, and so I'll be contacting those people in the next few days to arrange for that. Now that we're getting closer to Christmas and the rush is about to start, we'll be able to fundraise there. And that's what we're telling the High Court, that our time for meeting up with the people that we do the work for is during the summertime, because many people are away and hard to contact, and they'll be around, and so we should be able to collect that money. We're also doing things like talking to you this morning, and we're grateful. Thank you, Waiheke Radio, and networking as well. We've got obviously some internet links, and we're going to give you our website. Not our website. We haven't got that far. If anyone can do a website for us, that would be nice. But we have an email address and telephone and PO box.
Oh, okay, lovely. What's the email address and phone?
GDPA, that's Gulf District Plan Association, so the short for that is gdpa@extra.co.nz. And if people would write to us, I can send them information and send them our bank account details. Phone number here on Waiheke, 372-6388, and I'll get all the information they need about how to fund, how to commit a pledge, whether they do it weekly, monthly, or a lump sum. You know, even $10 a month will be great, because if there are 1,000 of us giving $10 a month, that's a lot of money. And so to meet our court debts, we have to do this. So we just get on with doing it rather than grumbling about whether it's right or wrong. The court said we must pay it. We will pay it. But whether we can do it today, tomorrow, or next year, that's the question.
Can it be forgiven?
The debt be forgiven only by the developer. The developer has got a court order against us, so
right.
It's up to the developer. If they believe that they've already made their point, and their point has been well taken, and that they could take us for dissolution to the High Court, they can. We'll defend ourselves, but they can. Well, the point's been made. Let's, for the community good, let's put that aside now and say, okay, one to the developer, and we'll carry on. So I'm hoping that common sense will prevail, and that we can, you know, we haven't had a sit down and face to face yet with these people. They will not talk to us. And, you know, I'm a reasonable person. We've got many professionals working for GDP who would be happy to negotiate this. We had one developer, another developer, who offered to pay off this debt. But it wasn't acceptable. So, you know, we're continuing to work with all sorts of people to see how we can resolve this.
Sorry, why wasn't it acceptable? I mean, money is money.
Because there was a desire not to. I don't know the details. Just one developer rang and said, you know, I've got lots of money and I do this and that, and I'm willing to see that GDP survives, and so I'll pay the debt for you. But this person wouldn't accept that, and the... It's a little bit complicated. I can't go into details.
Okay, fair enough.
But, you know, we're trying all angles, and we're continuing to. So if anyone's got good ideas, give me a ring on 6388.
So I think the point that I'd like to make is, you know, the Gulf District Plan Association is one of our strongest assets against development on Waiheke Island. They do lots of different things, but they are one of our strongest assets in that area. And without them, we would look like Fitianga. And they're involved in lots of really important things that protect our coastline, protect us from large store, you know, high story developments on the island. And they're a bunch of incredibly dedicated volunteers who work full time and yet give up their time to do this to protect all of us. So we really need to support them. So, yes, thank you very much, Jay, for coming in.
Thank you, Sharon. That was a good summary.
And good luck with all the campaigns, because I know a lot of people feel strongly about Afiti Bay, about Cactus Bay. I personally have a friend who's got property right next to the retirement village, and that was seeking to expand to twice its size, and the Gulf District Plan Association is still involved in that campaign to make sure that the development isn't too big.
Hmm.
So thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, good luck with that.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Oniroa.